has to do with landscape. Welcome back to the beginning of our serious pad part of the program. Later on, after lunch, Stuart Brand from the Long Now Institute will be speaking to us. He's sitting over there. He's been, I'm sure, a favorite of many of you, as he has been of mine for years. And thank you. And Jamie Boyle's talk this morning was fabulous for us. Jamie Boyle's talk on copyright this morning was outstanding for all of us. And I'm saying all of us because I see we have exactly the kind of conference here today that ELO, PAD, and the digital cultures people had anticipated would be the perfect situation to investigate these very difficult issues. And James Boyle's talk about the conceptualization of the idea of what it means to understand an intellectual commons or an idea commons is very close to the same kind of idea definition that the PAD group has been working with for an entire year. In the sense that, as most of you know, we need somehow to deal with the idea of the materiality of a literature that manifests itself differently from the print literature of the past, for which all the default rules are written and understood. So at the time that we began planning this conference, we were hoping to bring together experts and people whose focus had been on archiving, preservation, and dissemination issues for a while, so that we could move right into a kind of advanced debate about these issues. And so we can start off looking at this whole conceptualization of copyright, look at the idea of long time ahead or time frames, look at technological issues, and begin to see how we can pare them down into projects which might make a model that could be demonstrated to operate in some time frame that we are going to see. You know, that is a doable job. So we'll be trying to talk a lot about that. This particular session is for my PAD committee, which is archiving and display. This started off being Scott Rettberg's committee, then he became involved with his new job, and so I kind of took over. We have on the committee now Howard Besser and Alan Divac, both of whom will be having a little bit of a dialogue about how we can look at archiving and display and what these architectures might be. And this is a little outline of the way that we're going to cover this. My name is Marjorie Lucebrink. I'm right now acting as president of the board of directors of the Electronic Literature Organization. I also am a writer or a content producer. And as a content producer, I disport myself as MD Coverley. The idea as one of the people who criticized having a project to do preservation last year at the ELO symposium criticized the idea of preservation on the basis that authors should not themselves be concerned with their posterity, which is, of course, a very nice sentiment that authors would always be totally divorced from any attachment to what happens to their work after it leaves their fingers. And of course, I certainly would hope to stay on the pure side of that debate at all times. And so I want to assure you that I am acting only as Marjorie C. Lucebrink in my attempts to make sure that we preserve this literature. And it has nothing to do with that alter ego, M.D. Coverley. What we have in looking at copyright and the future is an architecture of ideas. And what I hope that archiving and display can do here is to say, okay, we've got an architecture, but we also always already have a texture, which is different than the structure of ideas that in fact informs a subject. And it oftentimes gets ignored, but we are operating in a field in which the texture is extremely important. And I'm talking about texture at the very level of vibrations. How fast do these molecules vibrate? What is the fabric of this problem and this work and this literature that we're looking at? One of the reasons why it's so important is because we operate as human beings materially in a world that is structured in our imaginations, and we count on those roads to be there and people to follow the stop signs and so forth, but we also count on materiality in a lot of other ways, and people have counted on the materiality of books and print for a very long time, and they make all kinds of assumptions about the world operating that way. When we don't operate by that same set of assumptions, then it's always necessary to go in and say, okay, what is this fabric look like? What is it doing? Well, one of the things that it is it's very new, and it's changing very quickly. And we all go, oh, I know, you know, change. Change is maybe the sorriest and most stale idea we can think of right now, because we've become so numb to it. Ex-literature, this conference comes from the Electronic Literature Organization, which is 3.5 years old, the Digital Cultures Project out of the UC system, which is almost 3 years old. PAD is only a year old. And all of these groups are very young in the context of, let's say, our monks in the scriptorium or even the UC system. But they actually, all three groups represent rather long-standing organizations in internet time. So what's really hard for us to catch on to, at least it's hard for me, even when I went to get these pictures and borrow them from the web for fair use, because this is an educational and non-commercial effort, and this is borrowed from the Vassar page. When I went to do that, I was immediately struck, and I've been here all along, with the antiquity of the works that we think of in our abstract brain as being, oh yes, so that's all part of the idea of electronic literature and hypertext and so forth. But the minute you start looking at something, you know, like the early ideas of hypertext with somebody's finger pointing at a page, we begin to realize how really antique the works of even 10 or 15 years ago look to us materially. They have all kinds of physical clues that say to us, oh, that's really old. You know, I'm looking at Nick and Noah, and of course, they've been working with this, so they're kind of not so surprised. But I was surprised, and I think about those works every day. But when I went back to look at them again and play with them, I thought, oh, they're so antique. They felt so ancient. Much the same thing, even with Rob Swigert is here, he wrote Portal. These are works from the late 80s. they were, of course, so cutting-edge that one still puts them in the cutting-edge category, and yet they are threatened, and the technology has changed so much in just those 10 or 15 years that we have difficulty even remembering what the fabric of those things were.
Was like.
The idea that everything that we saw in the early 90s was consciously reduced by the author to take as little bandwidth or download time or processing time as possible seems so long ago now. And oh well, you have to make sure that you've got a black and white GIF and you don't want to have too many lines of text on a page because in a slow machine with, you know, 42 megabytes of RAM, it's going to take all day. And now, of course, we think nothing of any of that.
This is Dina Larson's Marble Springs.
I think of, when we think of the classic days of hypertext, we think of Eastgate Systems and the Eastgate products that were largely created in story space. And those story space, that story space software, it's barely possible for us to even imagine now, was an entire navigation system all by itself, whereas now we would probably not expect to see numbers of writers using exactly the same navigation system, since now that you can design your own navigation system without a commensurate overload in terms of bits and bytes and weight of the weight on the processing speed, you probably wouldn't be using these days the exact same kind of processing. But we look back at these, and I never think of something like Afternoon a Story as being obsolete. The work is not obsolete, but the technology that represents it looks very antique to me. This is Stephanie Strickland's True North, and I use this as Stephanie's here. I use this as an example to show you what the time frame is of the evolution of this literature in terms of that texture. Stephanie was one of the first story space writers to use colored words, to color words that she didn't want to make links, to use maps. If you'll notice the Mother Lost World and all the True North maps, she's using these maps of the story space Lexia. And story space had been in existence, but with the exception of Dina to some extent, and then Stephanie to a great extent in True North, it was a brand new idea to actually signal the structure of the work in the way that you arranged the mapping. So that was 1995. Not so long ago, we're still like just discovering colored words. Whoa, are we moving ahead here? Okay, then something very strange happened, and that was, of course, right after 1995, we had the web, and we'll be talking, almost everyone that will be addressing issues today will talk about the relationship that the World Wide Web had on emerging electronic literature. But one of the things that it had was the effect of all the freedom of the commons and the problem of can an idea be like an overused goat? I love that idea. I'll have to think about that. Michael Joyce, for example, did three or four of my very favorite pieces on the web that actually never had very much readership at all because the copyrighted story space work seemed to people somehow more important. You know, you say to people, well, have you seen Lasting Image, which is just a gorgeous piece done by Michael and Carolyn Geyer, and people hadn't seen it. Stuart Moulthrop, also, who had been a Story Space Eastgate writer, moved on to the web with his incredible Reagan Library. And again, the problem of here he was giving away for free what Eastgate had been charging for, and a much more ambitious and extensive and sophisticated piece, like Reagan Library, comes out in the same kind of literature, but under these radically different audience presentation situations. And this, again, we're still talking 1999, and we look at this now with its bright revolving world, and that looks hopelessly antique. Hopelessly beautiful work, and not obsolescent text, because Stuart is so clever, but the whole idea of now I can move my mouse on this bright revolving world, which kept me enchanted for a whole weekend at home in 1999, now doesn't hold a candle
to what's going on.
I wanted to show you one more thing, and Jeremy and I have worked this up a little bit because it's going to take two computers to do it. The moving on to the web, which still represents the olden days in terms of the initial web work, put all of electronic literature at considerably more danger than it had. Than we think it had when there were publishers who were theoretically responsible for the archiving, at least for commercial purposes. But the other thing is that, and this is the kind of curve here, it's almost impossible some of the time as we move forward to be able to even explain to people, as in the way of understanding a concept and trying to articulate that in a way that the shadows of it will show. We move on to the web and we run into a problem in archiving and preserving where it's almost impossible to even demonstrate to somebody that something has gone wrong and that something is not working. For example, one of the pieces out on the web is a piece called My Boyfriend Came Home from the War. This is a work by Olia Lialina, who is a Russian writer. And she was enormously popular in the early web days because she's a designer, and she could do really stunning things with very, very limited bandwidth and coding possibilities and so forth. Well, what happened is that this piece, My Boyfriend Came Back from the War, was enormously popular, but it was not supported by the level 5 browsers. So within about 4 years, because it was one of the early pieces out there, within 4 years you couldn't read it, but you couldn't tell somebody you couldn't read it either. Because if someone went to the site to read My Boyfriend Came Back from the War, it appeared to work fine. However, because of the change in browser, the sound had disappeared from this file. And it was one of the most charming things in the file. I'm going to show you two quick things. I'm going to show you the way that My Boyfriend Came Back from the War, which is all done with black and white and frames, and the Harvey and Salmon version of that. They've been helping Lialina kind of keep her work. Their version, which actually captures the sound, which is lost in the HTML version now, in a QuickTime version, but the graphics are nothing like. So we'll switch now. Are we on? This is good tech. Thank you, Jeremy. This is the old original version of My Boyfriend Came Home Back from the War. After dinner, they left us alone. And
you can see it looks like it's working. Gee, that's wonderful. That's interesting. That this war in Chechnya, something is going on with. This actually goes on for quite some time. It's really a lovely piece, and it's a long dialogue between this woman coming back from the war. And the girlfriend. And I will let you go to see it. It's at my boyfriend came back from the war.com. Which Salmon and Harvey put out. And you can see the benefits here of the quickness of delivery in the entire black and white design and the chunking of the text in one link, big text chunk. Now, I'm going to go back here so you can see how simple this was, but how effective. That is, the work is not obsolete in its content. But we've got a problem with the delivery. No, it should be dialogue.
Copyright, since none of us are selling it.
Power. Whole copyright.